The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2007 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown Los Angeles as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit www.aloudla.org. It's a great pleasure to introduce Bernadette Murphy, who is a regular book critic for the Los Angeles Times and has written about life, literature, and art for many publications. She's also published 3 books. She's the author of the best-selling Zen and the Art of Knitting, which examine the links between creativity, spirituality, and knitting, and co-author with Michelle Hunnevin of the Dow Gal's Guide to Real Estate, which followed 6 modern women as they discovered the ancient art of finding, owning, and making a home and probably not getting foreclosed. And is editor of the anthology The Knitter's Gift. She teaches creative writing, and she was our guest moderator for both writer Mary Gordon and for Claire Tomlin. It's a great pleasure to welcome her back. Please welcome Bernadette Murphy.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thank you all for being here tonight. It's very exciting. We've got 2 of the hottest young novelists on the literary scene here tonight, and we're going to have a great conversation. I'm going to read an introduction for each of the ladies, and then they'll come out and join me, and we'll have a discussion from there. So I'm going to go alphabetically, starting with Nell Freudenberger. In her first novel, The Dissident, readers meet Yuan Zhao, a celebrated Chinese performance artist and political activist who's come to LA on a 1-year artist residency to teach at an exclusive all-girls high school on the West Side. During his year-long stay in Los Angeles, he's being hosted by the Travers, a wealthy Beverly Hills family whose daughter attends the school. As the plot unfolds, Zhao attempts to make himself at home in this affluent and very different world and to reconnect with his art. As readers are ushered into his past in Beijing and the political and artistic milieu of the 1989 democracy movement, in which the artist originally made a name for himself. Meanwhile, though, the Travers family is embroiled in its own messes. Cece, the devoted mother of the family, is emotionally engaged with Phil, the brother of her husband, with whom she's had a lengthy affair. The son, Max, has recently been arrested with a gun in his possession, and Olivia, daughter, is hanging out with a spoiled classmate who seems to have a penchant for shoplifting. All the while, Father Gordon, a psychiatrist, floats above the family, oblivious to its erupting distresses. It is against this very American background that Yuan Zhao enters into the visual artist's equivalent of writer's block, his utter inability to create something new, as questions hover about imitative art and artistic plagiarism. Ultimately, the novel asks readers probing questions about secrets and love, about the nature of artistic originality, and explores the difficulties we find in trying to live honest and authentic lives. Author Nell Freudenberger is no stranger to attention. Back in 2001, when she was 26 years old, she had her first short story published, the very first one, in The New Yorker. When her short story collection, Lucky Girls, was released, Salon.com published an article about her titled Too Young, Too Pretty, Too Successful, in which the author of the piece claimed that hating Nell Freudenberger had become a virtual cottage industry among ambitious literati. For all that snipe, though, Nell Freudenberger has proven she's a writer of great merit. She was awarded the 2005 Whiting Writers Award, and her collection of stories, Lucky Girls, was given the Penn Malamud Award. In addition to the Penn Faulkner Award for Excellence in Short Fiction, she has received the O. Henry Award for Short Fiction and the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her stories have been published in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Granta, the Best American Short Stories of 2004. I'm sure you'll agree with me that with what Publishers Weekly had to say, that the publication of her new novel, Freudenberger, has fulfilled her, the early promise she showed. She grew up in Los Angeles and now lives in New York City, where she's spending the 2007-2008 year as a fellow at the New York Library's Coleman Center. Our second author tonight is Jennifer Gilmore, who is the author of Golden Country. Golden Country is a sweeping, ambitious novel that vividly brings to life the intertwining stories of Jewish immigrants seeking their fortunes, a narrative that spans from the 1920s to the 1960s. Among the many vibrant characters, three in particular stand out. There's Seymour, who's handsome and ambitious. Thanks to his good looks and smooth manners, he finds his way into the lucrative connection with gangsters and just as easily is able to transition out of that world in order to become a Broadway producer. Meanwhile, the earnest Joseph works himself to the bone as a door-to-door salesman. He spends his evenings trying to invent a cleanser effective enough to wipe away the shame of his brother Solomon, who left their Brooklyn neighborhood to become the Terrier, a notorious gangster, much to the disgrace and heartbreak of the family. And then there's the irresistible Frances Gold, who grows up in Brooklyn, makes her debut in Seymour's first show, dreams of being a star, and marries the man who invented television. These people live the story of America at a very particular and changing time. The impact of Kristallnacht and the concentration camps are just beginning to make an impression on American Jews. World War II is a backdrop. As memories of the Depression fade, they are replaced by a new prosperity and a new world, one that includes airplane travel and television. It's a time of enormous change and growth. Of Gilmore's novel, Alyssa Chappell raves in Vanity Fair, "With a voice at turns wise and barbed with sharp humor, Gilmore warns, be careful what you wish for the American dream can sometimes be a nightmare." Gilmore herself comes from a background in publishing, having served as a publicity director for Harcourt. Thus, she brings with her an insider's knowledge. She received her BA from Brandeis University, where she majored in English and creative writing and minored in women's studies. She received her MA in fiction from Cornell, where she went on to teach creative writing. Golden Country was first published last September and is being released this month as a paperback. It was named a New York Times Notable Book of 2006 and a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Review. Her second novel from Scribner is tentatively scheduled for publication in 2009, and she lives in Brooklyn, New York. Please help me welcome Jennifer and Nell. You'll both need to move your mics closer to you. Welcome, this is Nell over here and Jennifer here, since you saw them all come in at once. And we're having a great discussion back in the green room about writing and their books, and so we're going to just continue that discussion here with you. And in the midst of discussing, we'll segue into having each author read a little segment of her book. But the first question that I have has to do with the subjects that you've chosen. When I teach in a MFA program, and I'm sure many of you have been to do the same, one of the things that we hear a lot in those programs is write what you know. And when I look at your books, I mean, you're writing about an immigrant experience that predates you, and you're writing about Beijing, China, and this artistic movement in Beijing. You know, it's not the stuff of your daily lives. How and why do you make the leap to these other realms? And is it a way of subverting the write what you know edict? Or is it in fact writing what you know? Either one of you, go for it.
Well, I mean, you can write what you know for a little while, and everybody has maybe a story that makes them want to start writing. But then at a certain point, you would just be so bored. I think you're always in a way writing what you know. You only have a couple stories, but you get interested in things. And the way it works for me is there's something that's exciting to me, and I start to read a little more about it, and then it seems like the way to start a story. And after I've gotten a little bit into it, I see, oh, I'm writing the same story I always write, but this time it's wearing the clothing of Chinese performance art, or last time it was an American experience in India. So.
Yeah, I mean, just to add, I think it's also to find out what you actually do know, and that we know more subconsciously than we realize. And I certainly didn't make the leap to write about India or China, but I was very close with my grandparents, and when my grandmother died, she left her diaries and her scrapbooks to me. So I heard her voice, you know, by reading these things, and could sort of make the leap of faith that perhaps I could get into the voice and the time of someone other than myself or some people I knew in the here and now.
Well, so now I'm really curious if your grandmother is Frances Gold, the letter writer, or
my grandmother is every one of these characters. Okay. And I always tell this story that she left me a daily record, and in it she talks about, you know, well, it was originally written just to say, you know, I'm going to be folding clothes at Filene's today, or getting my hair pin curled. And then every day she went out with the guy who would be my grandfather. There'd be a star in the daily record. And then one day there were three stars. So it made me, well, what's three stars? I don't know. But also, it made me think, well, this could be a diary from 1985 or 2007, and perhaps it's really not that big of a leap, that if you get the hemlines right and the haircuts right and the fabric right, then you can really write about anyone. And I'm sure it's the same if you do enough cultural research and cultural travel, that you can make those same leaps.
And tell us a little bit about the research you did to write about Beijing in that period of time.
Well, it started out just as an interest. I wanted to learn Chinese because I had left my day job, and I thought I finally had time to do that. And so it started with the language, and then I saw a show at the Asia Society in New York that was of these artists who are from the Beijing East Village. And now I think everybody's heard of these people, if not by that name. I think there were two articles in the New York Times last week about Zhang Huan, who was one of the artists I was reading about when I was doing research for the book. And eventually, after I'd read a lot about them and seen the photographs in particular, I went back for Travel and Leisure magazine and interviewed some of them, because it's always easier to tell somebody that you want to, that you're writing an article for a magazine, rather than, you know, I'm writing a novel and it's kind of based on your life. Do you want to sit down with me?
And your research, How did you go about it? I mean, these fabulous stories from a very different time, things with the World's Fair and the discovery of the cleanser, and
right.
Such specific details that are so rooted in the time. How did you get those?
Well, we were talking about this backstage a little bit, that there's so many different ways to do research now. It's not just sort of sitting in the library and in the stacks and sort of reading. I mean, there's obviously the internet, where if you need to know who won the Tony in 1956, you can just do that. But that doesn't really work when you're really researching something holistically. In the same papers that my grandmother left me, I found this book called Just the Two of Us, that the wife of the man who had invented Les Stoyl, I don't know if any of you all remember Les Stoyl, it was the first two-in-one cleanser, and it saved so much time for housewives, for people, it changed everything. But this guy was from Eastern Europe, a shtetl in Eastern Europe, and he came here and he invented it in his kid's bathtub. And his wife, his widow, wrote this story mostly about their romance, but I was very interested in this sort of door-to-door salesman who gets rich at this certain time in history where all these things were being invented, where physical things were being invented, like Sweet and Low. Rich Cohen writes about Sweet and Low. The depilatory cream was invented by a rabbi in Maine. Things that we really needed. So I was very interested in that. So that, I sort of got the voice that way and the idea. But you bring up the World's Fair, which is very interesting, because I was writing about the 1939 World's Fair, and it's sort of a climactic scene because so many of the characters show up there. And apparently, everybody who went to the 1939 World's Fair had the most amazing time of their life. And all they can say is, this was the most amazing day of my life, which isn't very useful to a writer. So I actually found footage of them building the fair and taking it down, and which was really fascinating. And so those were those two instances in particular. I think also I always put in a plug here for fiction, because we don't read it enough. But reading fiction about, you know, the Lower East Side, reading Delmore Schwartz or Anzia Yezierska, I think fiction writers, I mean, not just to say this because it's what I do, but have a way of describing the world, you know, how the light hit the street, what a plum tasted like, in a way that you really don't get from a lot of nonfiction.
Thank you. And we're going to transition into having Nell read us a section that takes place elsewhere and is examples of writing what you don't know or what you've come to know.
November 7th, 1993 was a bleak, lamplit afternoon in Beijing, the beginning of winter, when the air told you the season had changed for good. I followed the directions on the announcement card my cousin had given Mei Ling, but once I crossed the Third Ring Road and entered the winding lanes and alleyways of the East Village, I was immediately lost. Perhaps it was the cold, or the sudden absence of cars, or the transition underfoot from pavement to dirt, but I felt as if I'd crossed a boundary. As I got farther from the highway, it seemed as if a door had shut behind me. If I turned back, I would no longer find the gates of the workers' stadium thronged with bicycles or the high walls of the embassies. The city would be cloaked in fog, and there would only be the world before me, silent, old, in black and white. I was early, and so I walked my bicycle through the narrow lanes, past the dark, falling down farmhouses, the puddles of brown-green sludge, and a scared-looking yellow bitch, her teats nearly brushing the ground. For a few minutes, I followed a peasant who was pulling a cart full of garbage behind his bicycle. Occasionally, he would glance back, as if to make sure it was still there. But if what he collected was salvage, I suspected it was too pitiful even for him to care much about it. "Grandpa," I called out, "can you help me?" The man stopped and looked back warily. I was riding my new black Forever bicycle. My hair was growing out, and I had looped the silk cravat underneath my army jacket in preparation for meeting my cousin's friends. "I'm looking for lane number 7. The old man stared at my bike. "Do you understand me?" He shook his head. "Speak Putonghua?" I asked him. He smiled. Of course he had no teeth. "There are some artists around here," I tried again. "Do you know where they live?" Perhaps he did understand then, because he responded energetically in incomprehensible dialect, gesturing vaguely before pedaling off, the wheels squeaking under the weight of his fetid cart. I turned and saw a young man standing against the side of a house, apparently watching our exchange. He was wearing a camera around his neck. "Hello," I said. "I'm looking for my cousin's house." "Who is your cousin?" His face was distinctive, if not particularly handsome, with a high forehead and a bulbous, upturned nose. He spoke quietly, but his expression was noticeably friendly. When I told him X's name, he smiled. "Do you know him?" "Everyone knows him, even old Hua." He was saying, "You didn't want to find bad people like that." I couldn't understand him. "It's Fujianese. At first he liked talking with me. I'm from Fuzhou. But now that he's seen some of our goings-on..." The photographer paused. "Hey, are you here to see something that is not art?" "That's right, my cousin gave me a card for it." I rummaged in my pocket. I was perhaps a little too eager to show off my connection. "You're not far. Just turn left there, then right at the public toilet. You can't miss it, although it's much worse in summer. Keep going straight to the second intersection. You'll see a house with a sign on your right. At least I think there's a sign. Better hurry, he'll stop when the photographers leave." "Are you one of the photographers?" The question seemed to amuse him. "You could say, well, I am a photographer, but not the same kind. They were taking news pictures, but my kind of pictures, your cousin didn't want them." The photographer smiled and looked down. "Not that I blame him. I'm a problem for him this time. He's making something that isn't art, you see?" I nodded, although I didn't quite. "If I photograph him, then it is art, no matter who's making it. Problem is, without him, I'm nothing. Without me, his work disappears. That's the big question, see? Whose art is it?" I must have looked baffled because the photographer laughed. "Go on," he said. "You can still catch some of it." Then he continued the way I'd come, out of the village toward the Third Ring Road. At the time, I had no idea that I'd just met the man who'd invented the Beijing East Village and whose photographs are the only place where it still exists today. Even when the buildings were still standing, before the garbage was covered over and the inhabitants driven away, Tianming's East Village pictures turned this wasteland with its toilets and junk heaps and falling down houses into a place with a name. They were like a map, showing us not only where, but who we were. It's ironic, if not particularly surprising, that the pictures that brought our village to life were the same ones that would eventually destroy it.
Thank you. So in that case, you're not only writing in the voice of a Chinese artist, performance artist, but a male as well.
He's not exactly as much of a performance artist as he pretends to be.
I wasn't going to give that part away, but how does it feel to approach that voice? Was there any sort of trepidation in going into that?
Yeah, I mean, I had an idea, and the idea came really from meeting an artist when I was a teenager who was Chinese, who came to our school, and he was going to teach us how to paint with ink, but he didn't speak English, and the classes were silent. We started out painting rocks, and then if you did a rock to his satisfaction, you could paint a bamboo, and finally, if you came long enough, you could paint a lobster. And I was fascinated by this guy. I was a really terrible art student, but I thought of him when I started the book, and I really wanted the book to be in his voice because I wanted it to be mostly take place in LA, but really from an outsider's point of view. And the only way that I could think of to make his background realistic was to make him an outsider too. And so he's looking at this scene that I had been seeing the pictures. I had been looking at the photographs and reading about them. And he's the student kind of hanging on the outskirts. And then when he gets to LA, he's a little bit of a faker. And that's obviously what a fiction writer is all the time. So it's more comfortable.
Thank you. And Jennifer, in your work, the different voices and the different characters that you take on, you have men, you have women, you're spanning different time frames. Did you have trepidation? I mean, you had your grandmother's voice to guide you. How do you think her response to the work would be? Do you think you...
And she would say, why so Jewish? I think. No. Well, I will say, what do you know from Jewish? And I was going to say that Nell probably speaks Chinese better than I speak Yiddish. But first, it's all in third person. So it's not as many first person voices. But, you know, it was hard to decide what perspective to use. There is a large cast of characters, and originally they all sort of had a perspective. The women in the novel had a point of view. You got into their inner lives. And strangely, when I was paring it down, it was predominantly the men whose perspectives I retained. And I realized it's because the women in the novel, some of them are unhappy. And part of that is because they're so out of time in a way. They were so ahead of their time in a way, or what they could do was sort of confined by the social times, or by prohibition, depending on what character we're talking about. So I really found that I could see them very well, and that society saw them very well through their husbands. So I could sort of get at them and in that way. But it was very much about paring down the characters, and it was a very conscious decision how we were going to learn what we needed to know and from whom.
And how much did you lose in doing that? I'm assuming you had must have had.
I lost my favorite part. I lost my favorite part, but it became a very interesting, writerly act to decide to how do you show what you need to show with all these technical, almost impossibilities. And actually, first person is even worse because you have, how do you relay information to the reader without just telling the reader? So it actually disciplines you very well. You know, I want to get across somebody's misery, but I can't say I feel miserable. So they have to do things. And they're not all miserable, by the way. But it was actually, I think it made the book better. And in the end, I hope it made me a better writer.
What was the best part that you lost?
Oh, tell us. I can't even remember. It was just a scene when there's a character who is the wife of the man he's a gangster. He becomes a gangster, and then he turns into a Broadway producer. It's his dream to be a Broadway producer. And his wife was an actress, and she can't act anymore. She's had children, and they've gotten in the way of her career. And she turns to drink. And but there was a scene of her drinking, and it's during Prohibition. So how did I have this woman able to drink and have some fun drinking in a time when it was very difficult to go out and drink? So there was a time when she used to drink in the basement, and there was just a time when she was...
And at the basement of the Plaza, too, right?
Yes, at the basement in the Plaza she drank, too. But this is the basement of her own house, and she would dress up, and she would call it dancing. And she still does that in the book, but we don't have her point of view of it.
That's a lovely
scene. Which is also about what it means to be a woman in a man's world. And I had to show that in other ways.
And in both cases, your books are what reviewers have called ambitious, and that many first novelists don't shoot for big, ambitious novels, and both of you did. Is it because that's the only canvas you could imagine painting on, or... You know, did you want to start small? We were talking in there earlier about short stories and the constraints of short stories. Was it that you felt too constrained to keep to a smaller canvas, or why the big canvas, especially for a first novel?
Well, I'll answer that just for, and this is Nell's second book, so I think that it is interesting to talk about first novels, but, you know, it is... Can you repeat the question?
Why? Ambitious.
Oh, ambitious. 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 Well, I have a novel that I wrote in graduate school that had a 1,000 characters, and it took place over 17 continents. And I was like, next time, I am so not going to do this. And it's going to take place over 1 week, and it's going to be, you know, 4 people. And I started to do that. And then all of a sudden, this book took place from the 20s to the 60s, and it had, you know, and I realized that's just how I write. And it's why my teachers used to say, please don't write any more short stories. And they were like, you know, the rule is something like every character gets 2 pages of a short story, which of course is not a real rule because all these rules are really silly. But I had sort of like 17 characters for every 2. So I was really more suited to it. But in terms of ambition, you know, I do think, and it's changed a lot, but women weren't writing novels with big scopes for a long time, and I think that's changed a lot. And I'm glad for that because we all like big books with big ideas, and, you know, women should be writing them.
And yours, I mean, you not only span the time frame of the democracy movement in Beijing and all that to contemporary LA, it, you know, it's culturally very broad. What drew you to that?
I don't know. I feel like when you see ambitious in a review, you think, uh-oh, you know, they're saying that it didn't work. And you want to say, like, it's not ambitious. Just say it's good, you know? I think it's what you're interested in organically. And so sometimes you're going to write a story that's, I just wrote a story that was about my grandmother. I didn't need to do any research for it. I've been to Rochester, New York many times, more times than I needed to go, probably. And, you know, it came pretty quickly, I guess, for a short story. And with this, I mean, if you're going to be working on a project for, this was took me 3 years to write, which is not that long for a novel. I know Jennifer was working on that book for 6, you know, Jonathan Franzen said it took him 10 years to write the corrections. Hopefully what you're interested in over that period of time develops and changes, and that will go into your book. And the things that, you know, the things that escape you, maybe they're not meant to go into your book anyway.
And you raise a good question, how long it takes to write these. How do you sustain interest in your characters and the stories for that length of time?
Well, I mean, if you think about them as friends, you have friends for much longer. I always think that the people in your book are like friends who you were really close to, and then you lost their number. And that it's really not so long when you're getting to know people this well.
Yeah. And you, Jennifer?
Well, I didn't like mine as much. No, I'm kidding. I think that it took for this book, it took me a really long time to get to know these people, and I think that was really the work for a first time for the novel. In addition to building a book and figuring out how you build a book, really finding out who these characters were took me a long time. And once I did, they started doing things that I recognized, and the book went from there. So I wasn't with them for all 6 years. I wish that I had known them earlier. But I think, you know, going forward, that's changed a little for me. But I don't know. I think it changes with every book, with every friendship, as you say. I think that's a really good analogy.
Were there days you woke up and said, you know, I just can't stand these people a day longer, and I don't want to go there?
No, not entirely. I mean, I a little bit, but that was more the dread that with which I approach every day of writing.
So. Would you like to read a selection from your book for us?
Sure. Thank you. This takes place in 1925 in Brooklyn, and Francis. I didn't hear your introduction, but Francis had. Is a character, is a thwarted actress who was in love with Joseph, who invented Les Doyle, and her sister has just run off with Terry the Terrier, Joseph's brother. No one but Frances had an inkling that Pauline would be leaving. Frances knew of her sister's nights out, her impatience, and too many of her dreams. A mink stole draped over her neck, peacock-plumed hats, a large house surrounded by wooden fencing and supported by columns in the manner of the South, Pauline would tell her. And in 1925, there was no other way for a Jewish girl from Eastern Europe living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, to achieve these dreams than through a long white veil, a crushed glass, a clutch of yellow rosebuds. When Pauline entered the steaming kitchen one stifling summer evening, Rose Verdonik was mopping the floor vigilantly, sweat pouring down her brow. Abraham was wearing his spectacles and reading The Rise of David Levinsky to Francis for the third time.
He was trying to understand how this Yiddish-speaking man was able to write so well, so realistically, in English, when Pauline leaned against the doorframe. She said to her parents, "Don't be angry," she said. "Please don't be angry with me, but I'm going to marry Solomon Brodsky." Rose dropped her map. Abraham gasped, and they both looked at their elder daughter, stunned. "Who?" Abraham said. "What?" Frances looked down at her feet and wriggled her toes. Rose resumed scrubbing the floor furiously. "You heard her," she said in Yiddish, "the gangster with the glitzy clothes and the glitzy life. What kind of a girl?" Her voice trailed off. Frances remembered being dragged by her mother to see her old friend, Selma Brodsky, Solomon's mother, shunned by the neighborhood since the day Solomon drove away, when she thought no one was looking. They would sneak down the street, Rose pretending they were heading out for milk and eggs, and then Rose would quickly yank on Frances's wrist and dodge up the stairs to Selma's. The two women would talk about old times, what their lives had been like before something like this, as in this, could ever happen, and Frances loved the ease between them, something she rarely saw in her frenetic mother. Which was worse, they'd joke over herring, the Cossacks or summer in Brooklyn? Joseph was there, too, at the bottom of the stairs, wondering just who would be coming over now. He already seemed old to Frances, who occasionally would muster up the courage to go to him, and leaning on the banister, her chin on her hands, ask him about school or the weather or baseball. Joseph would answer factually, "I'm studying chemistry. It has been a hot summer. Isn't it awful about Babe Ruth's ulcer?" But all Frances really wanted to know was what it was like to be him, in his Joseph skin, to have his particular fingers and toes, and to walk the world as he walked. "Everything goes into this girl, and now she's leaving for a common criminal? I can't even think about it," Rose mumbled to herself in Yiddish as she continued to mop. "Mommy," Pauline said, hesitating, "he's not a criminal." Abraham was silent. He leaned his head to the right and then to the left, removing his wire spectacles. He closed the Kahan novel and watched his wife in her frenzy of cleaning. "Rose, please," he said, "this won't help." He stood and placed his hand at the small of his wife's back to still her. But it was Abraham who couldn't think about it. Had Pauline tried to pry apart her father's chest and slice open his slippery heart before she'd gone and broken it, she would have found only ghosts inside. The ghosts of his mother and father, the spirit of a sister he'd watched being taken. The ghost of his elder daughter was the last he could fit inside that beating organ. Frances knew, she could see it in the way her father's back was sinking before her eyes, that this final haunting bore down on him with its fogged spiritual weight. And like his friends who worked on the east side and walked over the bridge night after night, Abraham could no longer stand up straight. On the night Pauline told the Verdonics she was leaving, Abraham took to his bed. The next day, Pauline was gone, already a memory. Frances remembered the two of them playing marbles on the cracked sidewalk, their father walking out the door with his scratched leather briefcase. She thought of her sister, her tiny, delicate feet in Rose's button boots, shuffling across the room. She remembered Pauline's lovely face just the year before, the two of them perched by the open window, rhapsody in blue spilling in from a neighbor's radio. She couldn't think about it either, the way her father had worked and worked, only to have their names sullied by the likes of Solomon Brodsky. How her sister had ended up with a man who went by the Terrier, who hung around with that infamous Meyer Lansky, was beyond her. How could this be the same girl who had played stickball with Frances and the boys on their street? That had been before Pauline discovered that she was beautiful, and before Frances discovered that she was not. It was before they knew that they were not like boys, that they would never get for themselves what boys could get. Pauline, with her long, thin arms, had batted the ball, and it rolled between Solomon Brodsky's legs, all the way down the block to Mr. Berkowitz's candy store. Frances ran after it, the protective eye of her older sister behind her as she peered inside the store, its chocolates wrapped in golden foil, stacked in the window. That was when she heard the ever-present voice of her mother. "Eating outside the house," her mother screamed in Yiddish. "The dysentery," she yelled, her hand over her heart. Frances had picked up the ball from the street and turned away from the window to run back toward her sister, toward Joseph, forgetting for a moment the unfamiliar longing to reach for those golden candies and for just one second to have a look inside.
Thank you. The golden candies reminds me of the title of the book.
Good.
You know, and the metaphor of, you know, coming to this country, streets paved in gold. And both of your books are in a way a critique on American society. In your case, the characters come, struggle, look for this golden country, and don't really find it. And in your case, with the Travers family, you know, this affluent
family that's completely bonkers in certain ways. You know, it's skewering American, what we think of our society in a certain way, and what we think of ourselves. Did both of you set out with sort of wanting to comment on American society in the works that you wrote?
I think you're dead if you start out wanting to comment on a big theme, right? I mean, with that's as true of painting or music as it is of writing. But hopefully you get to something like that, just focusing on your small things that you're writing about.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I thought that either, although I do think that there was this promise, you know, you could come here and it happened, you know, go to Florida, buy real estate, and it was all wetlands. Or, you know, it happens now. It's, you know, I was very interested in writing about failure. You know, I always thought of myself as a failure. I think that our notions of success and failure are interesting. And I like that people are always failing, even when they're succeeding. So I think that speaks, you know, on the smaller level of the characters and then on and on from there, I suppose.
And in both your books, I'm interested in the way you've put the books together. In Jennifer's case, the chronology is very thrown to, you know, things happen in very different orders. It doesn't follow a straight chronology. And in Nell's case, it's more of a straight chronology, but there's big sections of backstory that predate the present action of the story. I'm curious as to know how you put that together, whether you wrote them in the order that we receive it as a reader, or whether you wrote the character's backstory first and then figured out where it fit in, or, you know, how that came to be, that it was in the order it's in when we read it. Is it the Dance of the Seven Veils, where you're trying to, you know, not reveal certain things until you absolutely have to, and that was very conscious? Or how did it come to be in the order that you wrote your book?
Well, I definitely don't write parts, and then sometimes you get sort of on a tangent, and then you realize you need to stop and put something somewhere else. But for the most part, I wrote it in the order that it is in the book. But I definitely struggled with that, especially with a first-person narrator who's lying to the people that he's staying with. I struggled with sort of how to give the information, how to have a natural voice where the character knows something that the reader isn't going to know until, you know, three-quarters of the way through the book. And I'm not sure that that's how a reader would experience it. I mean,
Yeah, but I mean, it's very much where he's not only lying to the people he's living with. In a way, he's not lying to the reader, but he's not telling the reader the whole story. So, you know, how were you deciding how much to say, and at what point you tip over the balance where the reader starts to figure out, aha, I see what's going on. And I don't want to ruin the plot for you guys, so I'm not going to tell you what does happen. But there is this dance with him and what he's willing to reveal and what he doesn't fully reveal to us as readers. Was that difficult to figure out how much to tell the reader and when?
Well, it was difficult to sort of have the confidence to do it because it seemed like more of a problem when I was starting than it turned out to be. And I think it's what we were talking about before when we were sitting in the room. And I said to Jennifer that I didn't think I could write a book that took place in the past because I just wouldn't know what every little thing looked like. What if you needed to describe a doorknob? I didn't know what sort of doorknobs they would have in a Lower East Side tenement in 1925. And Jennifer said, of course, just don't write about the doorknob. And it's obvious, and it's the same thing, you know, I know some Chinese words, not that many, you know, so I don't use the ones that I don't know, and, you know.
Well, Nell's structure I have in her book is very tight, you know, it's very tight and it's very together, and it's very admirable that it came that way, because she splits things up and does keep the reader going in this really wonderful way. And I hope to do that in my next book. this book was, I think of this as a very linear book now. Because it was all over, there was a present tense, it was present and past, because of course that's memory, and we have to recreate memory when we write, and I had all these ideas, but it became just, you know, completely insane, and I didn't have a timeline, so I was just trying to remember all these dates, and then it kept getting bigger and bigger, and when I finally copy edited the book, I'd say, you know, 15 years ago, and the copy editor would be like, 9 years, you know. So I wasn't very good at the math, and in fact, to be serious, it was in an entirely different order. It started with this big wedding, which takes place much later in the book, and it was very interesting because I knew who all the characters were. So when you start with a wedding and there are all these characters, the reader doesn't know who they are. So it's their first introduction. And when I have the exact same scene much later now, and because I've already done all this work to create who the characters are, that scene was so much easier on the reader. So there was a lot of cutting and pasting and that kind of thing to find a structure that I feel was more linear, even though it certainly goes back and forth in time and you know, how we remember things. But, yeah, next time.
Okay. I'm also curious because both of you, these are first novels in both cases, but Jennifer, you worked in the publishing industry for a number of years as a publicist, and Nell, you published a book of short stories prior to this. Was the experiencing of publishing a first novel after knowing those realms in the publishing world easier, do you think, than if you hadn't have known that, or was it still as surprising, wonderful, upsetting? And what was the most interesting part of the publishing process for you?
Well, I'll just answer that. For me, I had a lot. I was the head of publicity for publishing for Harcourt, and so I had a lot of knowledge about the publishing business, and I didn't need to be told, you know, when you get galleys and who you send them and how that it all works in the process and even the editing process. But somehow, when you become an author, That all that knowledge just didn't get carried over, really. I mean, even though, you know, I manage expectations for writers every day, and I say, you know, don't expect it to be packed, or don't expect to get a review, you know. But then when it was my book, I was like, all right, here I am.
Here's everybody.
So I tried to carry some of that knowledge with me, and I tried to be easier on the publicist and even my editor than a lot of authors are. But I think in general, I mean, it's what I was speaking about. Fiction is very hard, and knowing that, working in publishing and being on the editorial board, I had to separate that as a writer when I was actually writing, or I never would have written a book. There's so many books published, it's just completely daunting, and you get jaded when you're in publishing. So how do you not be jaded as a writer? You have to be separated. And you know, I felt like I was very lucky with my first book, but you know, you never know.
And you know, did you feel prepared when your first novel came out after your experience?
After
publishing your collection of short stories and having received such great publicity early on, was it, you know, just go forward, or?
I think it's about separating publishing books from writing, and the writing never gets any easier, but the publishing part gets easier. I mean, when I first started, I couldn't stand up and even do a reading. I mean, my heart would start going so fast, and I just wondered how people did it. And it turns out a lot of people do it with beta blockers, which is a big secret that I didn't know. But that part does get a little easy.
Noted.
But I think the trick is then to be able to go back into your little room and do your writing and put all the other stuff out of your head.
I think that's so true. My agent once told me, she's no longer my agent because she's ill now, and she'd been in the business for a very long time. She was Saul Bellow's agent. She would take me out to lunch, and she'd say, you know what? I mean, she said the same thing over and over again. But you know what? Publishing has nothing to do with books, writing, and writing has nothing to do with publishing. And I would be like, yeah, Harriet, okay. But it was true, and that's exactly what you're saying. I mean, in many ways, publishing is trying to sell something, you know, a vacuum cleaner, a book, and they're very nice people doing it, but it can be very hard.
And is the experience of writing, now that you've each come out with a very successful first novels, is the experience of going back to write now a second novel easier, or is it still just as difficult as the first time?
It's still just as difficult, definitely.
Well, I feel like Nell had so much for her first book of stories that the second book must have been, you know, hard to sort of sit down with all that noise, and that maybe you're more used to the noise now.
You mean
in your head of, you know, this is what people wrote about the first book, or how do you respond with the second book? No?
You mean thinking about the publicity that was for the first
book?
Yeah,
or what was written about the book and all of that, yes.
I was in an unusual situation because a lot of it was written before the book was written, that I wrote a story, and then because the story got sold, you know, and usually the short stories, people were just interested in the idea that all of a sudden collections of stories were selling, because for a long time the rule was that only novels sold. And so it was so weird to, I was an editorial assistant at The New Yorker, and, you know, I answered the phone and got coffee and did Xeroxes, and all of a sudden to have a lot of articles about the book that, you know, you haven't written, people saying probably she can't write it, and I was like, yeah, probably I can. I mean, I don't disagree with you, you know. But then to have a chance to leave, it was worth it, because to have a chance to leave and try writing, you know, every day and have that be my job, I mean, we're so lucky to to get to do that, you know, for however long it lasts.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. In many ways, it is easier because I don't have to get up at 5:30 in the morning and write before work and write on the weekends, which seemed very unsustainable for a long period of time. So in that way, I think it is easier just to be given time and to feel very grateful for that. But there is this sort of, you know, I hope, I don't even remember writing. I mean, I don't know who wrote that. And so it's a strange experience.
And I was curious about your experience after the New Yorker piece came out, and there was a lot of publicity. It's interesting when you were talking about your character and him being a fake, and that's what it feels like to be a fiction writer. I'm wondering if there's a correlation between the pressure that your character felt in Los Angeles to create art, and all these people sort of standing. He has to do a show by the end of his residency, and he's, you know, basically copying someone else's thing the whole time. Is that indicative of the pressure that you felt at that time when all these articles came out and all this expectation on your novel?
Yeah, I think it is, but I also think that every time you start out to try to make something that's supposed to be art, you feel it sort of works that way. And what I was thinking about with this book, and especially as I was looking at the work that these artists did, was just the way that we learn to make art. And of course you learn by looking at other people's work or by reading. If you're a writer, it's always by reading. And, you know, you learn in this very inefficient way. You read just because you're the kind of kid who likes to read, as opposed to the kind of kid who likes to play soccer or whatever. And you read and read and read, and then 20 years later, maybe you've learned something from a book you read, you know, when you were a kid. Or, you know, you hope by the end of your life that you've been reading Grace Paley and Alice Munro and you'll learn something from one of them. But it's not an efficient kind of learning where you take notes and then the next day you can put it into the book.
I mean, I think if you're a success or not, I think the act of writing does feel very fraudulent. And I have a section in this book where Frances, who you just heard from, she becomes the letter writer for the neighborhood when her sister leaves, and she translates from the Yiddish to the English so that the older generation can communicate with the younger generation. And she starts to feel that she's experienced, you know, places that she's never been, gone to, you know, Prague, and, you know, dipped her feet in rivers that she's never seen, and she takes those stories on. And I think it's those aren't her stories, but because she wrote them, she feels they are. So they have become part of her in a way, even though she's completely ripping everyone off.
Yeah, well, and any fiction, any writer, after the years and years and years of reading, those things start creeping into the work, you know, the stuff that you love, maybe not directly copying, but that it influences the writing that you go on to do. And I find it amazing that no matter how much people go on to publish, there's still that sense of fraudulency somehow in our work because, you know, so much we've gained by osmosis in the things that we've read.
Well, and I think there's this myth with creative work that it's supposed to happen, that it's supposed to be completely original and happen like a bolt of lightning. And obviously, you know, obviously it doesn't happen this way. I think that the reason I was drawn to this guy who came to teach us how to paint with an inkbrush is that he corrected us. I mean, even though he didn't speak English, he would say, you would make your lobster, and he would point to the legs and say five, you know, and so my lobster had four legs. Like, what, you know, I was being creative. But no, I was being wrong. And the idea that you would learn by doing it exactly the same way and making it exactly the same every time was sort of a new thing, and that it was okay to imitate because that was the way that you finally came to something that would be in your own voice was exciting to me.
And he goes on, I mean, by the end of it, he's making this beautiful, long piece of art, but it's basically copying another thing, but it's still a creation.
Well, it's copied, and it's a real piece of art, and you can see it at the Met. It's the most beautiful thing. It's called Liu Chen and Ruan Zhao entering the Tiantai Mountains. And it's about these two guys who go into the mountains and eat a magic peach and meet these immortal ladies. And it's just, it's just really spectacular.
But when he's creating it, in reading it, it feels like we're watching a creation that's as original as anything else, even though he is copying something. So, it's that creation is original even when it's taking its inspiration from another source and not happening in a vacuum, as you were saying. Yeah. Tell me about your process, about how you ladies work.
You want to start with your process?
I get up and, I feel like I have to just go downstairs and work before the impurities of the day sort of get in. I'm not someone who can write at night. I have to write in the morning pretty much before doing anything. And hopefully I'm, semi-dressed. And I write in the morning, and I try and write as long as I can. And then usually in the afternoon when I'm sort of woozy and after I walked my dog, I try and go over maybe what I've written earlier, or I do other sorts of work, like write reviews and that kind of thing. But I'm, it's very hard to sustain it for a very long period of time. And when I worked in an office, you have people coming in and out of your office, you're checking email all the time, which I do 1,000. That's part of my process now. Write a sentence, check my email. It's part of my process. What this notion of what's productivity has been very difficult for me in the past couple of months after leaving a day job to feel like I've accomplished anything. I mean, you're only putting out your own fires, and how do you feel? And a bad day, it's easy to have a bad day. One bad writing day, and your day is pretty shot. So how do you? Part of my process is trying to find ways to feel okay with whatever I've done. So it's been difficult to sort that out, navigate that.
And Nell, how do you work?
The same way. I write in the morning for three. I do new stuff for 3 hours, and if I've done it for 3 hours, then I just tell myself that's enough. And then in the afternoon, I do the other stuff, the freelance work, or sometimes editing, but. It's really, that's as long as I can do it. I have a friend whose book you maybe have read. It's called Natasha. His name's David Bezmoges. He's just a great writer. The way he does it is by word count. And so he writes 500 words a day, no matter how long it takes him, and then he stops. And for me, it's hours. But I think you just need something to make sure to tell yourself it's okay. As long as I've done that, then I've done my work.
There's always such a bit of trepidation and seriously dread every time I approach my job now, and it's sort of overcoming that. It's not dread because I do love what I do and I love to write, but it's just this entering the, once you enter it, it's great, but sort of making that leap out of the here and now and into the problems of this other world is hard, I think.
And then the last question I have, and then we're going to open it up to the audience, is we were talking backstage beforehand about novels versus short stories, and Jennifer made the comment she's never writing another story again. So well, I would, a rash comment, we hope.
They're so hard to publish anyway.
But I'm curious to know how the working on a short story varies, from working on a novel. Do you take a break from the novel writing to write a story? Is that sort of a treat? Or how do you work the balance between short stories and novels, and what are the joys of each?
I started out writing stories, and I love writing stories, and I didn't write any while I was working on this book, but when I finished it, I wrote a couple, and I guess the short stories I write aren't, one of my favorite writers is Grace Paley, and I'll never write a story that's 5 pages long. I don't think I'm just not good enough. It's like I think short story writers feel that way about poets. How compressed can you be? But on the other hand, I love Alice Munro, and she writes these long novelistic short stories. So that kind of gives you hope if you're more that kind of writer. But I think for me, it's like to finish. I can't work on two things at once. So in between, it's nice to, if you have an idea, it's really nice to work on something where you can sort of see the end in a way that a lot of times you can't with a novel.
Yeah, just to talk about Grace Paley, I think she taught me that I couldn't write a short story also. But I learned so much about voice from her, and she has these tremendous, amazing voices, and in 5 pages, these characters incredibly well. But once I started writing novels, I felt this joy of having a cast of characters and just waking them up in the morning and putting them to sleep at night. And I had a lot of trouble with just coming up with, you know, again, getting to know characters, getting to know a time and place in between the stories. So a novel, in many ways, seemed like a relief to me. I'm sure all this is going to, you know, completely jinx me, and I will never write a novel again, and I'll just, you know, writing...
You'll be writing brilliant three-page stories.
Graffiti on the streets.
And it turns out I lied, because I do have another question that I just have to get in before we take questions, which is, what are you working on now, both of you? Tell us a bit about your project, if you can, whatever you can reveal at this point.
I'm writing a novel that it has to do with a friend who I met on the airplane from Manhattan to Rochester, where my grandmother lived, and my grandmother had just passed away, so I was going up there to help my dad with her house. And... I was reading a novel by Amitabh Ghosh called The Hungry Tide, which is a great book, and it takes place in Bangladesh. And there was a young woman sitting next to me who looked as if she'd recently come, I thought, from India. And we started talking, and it turned out she was from Bangladesh, and she was, in fact, from the Sundarbans, which is in the south, and right where the book took place. So that was interesting to me. And she said, I was born there, my grandmother still lives there. And I said, oh, well, my grandmother lived in Rochester. And we started an email correspondence because of this, and then... she kept saying, maybe someday you'll come visit my grandmother with me. And I thought, yeah, you know. But we went in February, and it was amazing. And so somehow from that trip, this book, I hope, will come out.
Jennifer.
My book takes place in Washington, D.C. in 1979, so I thought, great, the research is going to be so much less for this. But that's not the case. And it's about... sort of the decline of radicalism and the Soviet threat, and it was right at when Carter announced the grain embargo. It's very much about food in that time when we sort of thought there was going to be this global food shortage. So I'm reading about, you know, the Cold War and the difference between Trotsky and Stalin and all sorts of things. But it's basically about this family and this shift of dynamics and decline of radicalism and LSD and... We'll see.
You have a multiple third-person points of view in it?
It's basically, I'm sticking to four.
Okay. And are you still in first person?
I'm sticking to four.
Is your new work in first
person? It's in third person.
It's in third person. Okay, very cool.
I will never write in first person again.
Okay. Careful, you're doing a lot of numbers tonight. So. And now we'll open it up to questions. If you have questions out there, we have... gentleman with a microphone back here who will bring it to you so that your question can be amplified and we can all hear it. We have a question down here in the front. Thank you. Yes, please. Thanks so much.
I'm going to start with you, Jen, and then maybe both of you have an answer for this. But I'm curious about when you talk about, Jen, you said you didn't write a timeline. You didn't have a timeline for the novel. So I'm curious when you, about redrafting, when you go back and have to redraft something, do you each have sort of a small circle of trusted friends or readers who you can actually bounce your ideas off of, or, you know, your first draft off mm-hmm. of, and then you go back and redraft? And if so, how many times? Is it many, many times?
With this book, I do have some very trusted readers, which is great. You know, after a draft or... I would say after one draft is still about eight drafts because you're redrafting as you go within it. And I'm lucky that way that I get great feedback from some of my friends. But it's interesting because in terms of history, if you take something out and I have, you know, Guys and Dolls, and whenever the first production of Guys and Dolls happened, or The Wizard of Oz took place, you know, I needed it to be during this time. But when I redrafted certain things or revised certain things, that fell away. So how, when I needed the Wizard of Oz to be there, it had in fact come out later. And so I sort of cite Philip Roth with his idea of alternative histories in The Plot Against America, and think, well, you know what? The Wizard of Oz, just, it's going to be, you know, 6 months before it came out is when I'm saying it came out. And Mae West ended up in Brooklyn in my book, not Queens. But and then I know if I'm going to get some reviewer, you know, some Garland freak, who's just going to talk about that. But in general, when you're using history, history doesn't move, and of course, your writing does. So in some way, that's a relief because you're anchored to these certain things, and they help make your decisions. But then in some way, the unmoving quality makes you make decisions you might not make. But in terms of how many revisions, I was looking at my Golden Country file the other day because I was trying to find something, and it was like Golden Country, number 123. You know, it was a lot of drafts for that.
And you, Nell, do you have a group of readers who you show your first drafts to, or how do you do that?
I wish I did, but not really. I have a couple friends who I show things to, but I'm really shy about showing it until it's pretty far along. So I do, I guess I maybe struggle a lot more by myself than I need to, because it would be nice to have people, you know, sort of steer you in the right direction when you're going off course. I didn't let my husband read it until it was like in between covers. I mean,
it's hard to find that. And, you know, because if you have one or two, you're really lucky. But then how many times can you ask them?
Yeah,
so you
have to be very careful. Once they've seen it once, yeah. You know, it's not as fresh the second time. I mean, by the time they've read it like the fifth time, they're not giving you a fresh.
Yeah, they can't even. Yeah. They're in just as much trouble as you are. Yeah.
Do we have other questions? Over here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bernadette, bringing these books to downtown Los Angeles and these authors. My question is for Jennifer. Why did your grandmother leave you her journals, and how did you know to do something with them?
It's not exactly
how
the true story.
How were you not paralyzed by that?
No, she did leave them to me, but my mother stole them. So, but no, basically, I had a relationship with my grandmother where she used to just tell me a lot of stories. You know, I'd be like, I had a lot of trouble sleeping as a child. I was a very scared child. And my grandmother would sort of, I'd be like, tell me the story about when my mom had the crooked part in the photo, you know, and she would tell me these stories that became very mythic to me, you know, or the time, you know, she went out with this guy with the biceps, you know, so I think we always talked and communicated, and that was reflected, and she wanted to give that back to me, I think. My sister is an artist, and she left her these home movies and slides. So I think it was just to give us her life and access to it, even what we'd never talked about.
Well, mine isn't really a question. It's a comment. Jennifer is my former boss at Harcourt, and I'm just so tickled to see her here, and I'm so proud of her because I always thought she was a lovely writer, and it's just nice to see it come to fruition. So congratulations.
Thank you, Tricia.
Any other questions before we wrap it up? Well, thank you all for coming out tonight and supporting literature in Los Angeles. The authors will be out in the hallway, out in the foyer, signing books afterwards. Please support them and buy their books, and thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you, and thank you all for having us.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.